Curtis Administrator for Highfield et al. Robert Clark, Patrick Malone, Appellant Counsel, Michael Osefsky, Michael Sedensky, Appellate Counsel.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Al Clark, on behalf of the appellant and plaintiff at the trial court, Ms. Shea Curtis, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my argument for rebuttal.
All right.
The sole issue in this appeal is whether the trial court erred in striking the plaintiff's punitive damages claim at the conclusion of her case in chief. Despite evidence that the defendant, Dr. Highfield, supplied his patient, Mary Jo Curtis, with a constant stream of powerful, addictive, narcotic drugs on demand, 52 separate prescriptions totaling over 2,400 pills for 14 months straight without ever once formally monitoring her, examining her, or even seeing her in an office setting. And he did this despite his conscious awareness that these particular drugs carried a high risk for addiction, abuse, overdose, and even death. And he did this with a conscious awareness that Mary Jo Curtis was a particularly vulnerable patient who was at even higher risk for these dangers. The prescriptions only stopped when Mary Jo Curtis died of an accidental overdose from the very drugs that Dr. Highfield supplied to her. I want to make clear at the outset, and I think the trial record proves this, this is not a case of simple, ordinary negligence, as the appellee asserts. Rather, Dr. Highfield's conduct in this case was so egregious that he did not even attempt to defend it at trial. Rather, he conceded his negligence.
He didn't attempt to defend his negligence, but he certainly did attempt and was successful in attempting to defeat the assertion that he was wantonly and willfully disregarding life.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. The point in saying that is that this is not a case of simple negligence. It goes far beyond that. In fact, defense counsel in the appellee brief that was filed with this court even acknowledged that Dr. Highfield's conduct could be so shocking to reasonable-minded people that a jury could conclude that he was guilty of gross negligence.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Was the decision by the defendant to concede that he was negligent, did that have any impact on the evidence that was presented to the trial, to the jury about anything?
I believe it did. It limited plaintiff's ability to really ask certain questions as to why Dr. Highfield did what he did, the level of knowledge that he had regarding the dangers and the risks associated with these medications and with giving these medications to his patient who was particularly susceptible. So there was a limiting factor to that. However,
did it have an impact upon the evidence you presented, were able to present, in claiming punitive damages?
I believe it did. It did, Your Honor. And in fact, we never even had the opportunity to cross-examine, if you will, some of the proffered testimony that Dr. Highfield gave in his case in chief. We would have been able to do that, and we would have also been able to call rebuttal witnesses that would have called into question the veracity of his statements and his representations. When it goes back to this case, there's certain aspects of this case that everyone agrees with, right? Number one, I think everyone agrees that physicians in Virginia can be held liable for punitive damages in medical malpractice cases. And number two, I think that everyone pretty much agrees what the standard is for punitive damages. This is a statutory claim for punitive damages under 8.01-52 subsection 5, and that says punitive damages may be recovered for willful or wanton conduct, and importantly, for such recklessness as evinces a conscious disregard for the safety of others.
I apologize. May I interrupt you again? Justice Millett's question about the nature of the stipulation on ordinary negligence perhaps having some procedural shackles on the ability to make out a prima facie case of punitiveness. Can we go back to that topic? Tell me if I have my facts right. You lost your punitiveness on a motion to strike, right?
That is correct.
At the end of the plaintiff's case in chief?
That is correct.
Okay, so what stopped you from putting on your punitiveness case? It was alive until it was thrown out.
That is true, and we did put on evidence of punitives.
So how could any stipulation made on ordinary negligence have any procedural effect on your trial strategy seeking to advance a claim of punitives?
Well, let me be clear that I don't believe there's a question that we did put on evidence of punitives and that the evidence reached the level to allow that to go to the...
I'm not trying to suggest you didn't. I was trying to understand that. Was there any effect, let me ask it differently, was there any effect at all on their concession on ordinary negligence on your ability, your full and fair opportunity to make your case for punitives?
I do not believe there was a procedural bar. That stipulation that we had entered into had nothing to do with the punitives claim. It simply had to do with the ordinary negligence claim. It was essentially, you know, both sides agreeing, we're not going to call standard of care witnesses in this case. He acknowledges he was negligent. But I think there were certain decisions during the process of us examining Dr. Highfield that were objected to on the basis of this goes to standard of care and therefore it is no longer relevant. We believe
during their case in chief?
During our case. Dr. Highfield was called as an adverse witness for the plaintiff.
Okay, so you still had a punitive claim alive during your case. Why are you not objecting to some evidentiary rulings during your case in chief that stymied you from, as you put it, or imply rather, from making out a full and fair factual record for it?
2 points, Your Honor. First, we did object to two pretrial rulings that the court made that went directly to our punitive damages case. One was the introduction of Dr. Highfield's knowledge of the opioid epidemic that was going on in Virginia at the time he was treating this patient, and his concession at his deposition that doctors play a role in leading to that epidemic. That knowledge goes directly to punitive damages because it went to his awareness of the risks and consequences of his behavior. Number two.
Except for that, because that was not granted here, of course.
Correct.
And that was a different issue from, if you wanted to cross-examine him to show that he was saying something factually untrue, he claims he didn't know about the record, he didn't know about the progress of this patient, it had nothing to do with the opioid crisis in the newspapers. It had everything to do with the facts of this one case. Was there anything about the concession of the defendant that somehow unfairly limited your capacity to bring out the best punitive case you had?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Like I said, I believe that there were some decisions made at the trial court level that prohibited us from asking certain questions based on an objection having to do with standard of care. However, we did not raise any of those evidentiary issues because we believe there was more than adequate evidence as to both his conscious awareness of the risks and dangers of his activity and his reckless disregard for Mary Jo Curtis's safety by continuing on his pattern of constantly providing these drugs
well,
to her.
So give us a bullet list of 3 to 4 or 5 facts that say you were over the line for purposes of a motion to strike.
Of course. So let's start off with, there's two elements, right? Let's start off with what did he know? What was his conscious awareness? Number one, he testified he knows that Percocet, the drug that he gave her for 44 months straight, carried a high risk of addiction, abuse, overdose, and he said even death. He knew that these drugs were actually even more risky when they're given long-term or chronically. He knew, he testified, he has patients in his own practice that, quote, abuse and misuse these drugs all the time. He knew that patients taking these medications needed to be regularly monitored, the inference being that it's dangerous to give out these drugs if you're not watching these patients. He knew that alcohol abuse, patients with alcohol abuse, are at even higher risk for abuse, addiction, and death. He knew that patients with bipolar disorder were at even higher risk for addiction, abuse, and death. And he knew, importantly, that Mary Jo Curtis was a particularly vulnerable patient who had both of those comorbidities. She was bipolar, and she suffered from alcohol abuse, or at least he acknowledged that she drank vodka on a daily basis. So that was the evidence that he knew, I'm dealing with very dangerous drugs, these drugs require monitoring, and she is a particularly susceptible patient. So then we look at, well, What was his actions based on this conscious awareness? These are the facts that came into evidence. And I want to focus just on the relevant time period from April 2013, when he last saw her, to June 2014, when she died. That's 14 months. What did he do? He continued the chronic, long-term treatment with narcotics. He sat down on 52 separate occasions, pen to pad, and wrote out 52 prescriptions for Percocet. And during that entire period of time, he acknowledged, I never formally monitored, I never examined her, I never saw her in the office setting. He knew that he could only monitor patients for the signs and symptoms of abuse if, in fact, he saw those patients in his practice. He acknowledged that. It's the only way he could do it. And finally,
you got your 5 minute mark, but
let me finish my one point, and I
sure,
will thank
use
you for the reminder.
You like.
He knew that Mary Jo Curtis was not using these drugs correctly. He knew she was abusing them. He knew that she was misusing them. He wrote two prescriptions, 40 pills each.
Could have known.
No, he knew. He knew. 3 days apart, he wrote two different prescriptions for 40 pills. He says she should be taking it once or twice a day. Anybody can do the math. The jury can do the math. In the last 6 weeks of her life, he wrote out 9 different prescriptions. He has to know that she was taking more medication, and he saw that she was taking significantly more during those last 6 weeks of her life. That was the evidence from which any reasonable juror could conclude that he acted recklessly in the face of the knowledge that he had regarding these dangers generally and with regard to these dangers specific to Mary Jo Curtis. And a jury found that that caused her death. Thank you. I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Michael Oshesky, and I'm here on behalf of Dr. Hydeville, and I apologize to the court. I'm suffering from the flu, so I will be as brief as I can be, and also I'll be at a slower pace, and I apologize for that presentation. I think the trial court should be affirmed in this case. I think the decision made by the trial court was absolutely appropriate. This is a case of negligence. That's why it was stipulated to in this trial.
But going back to the stipulation, I don't know why both of y'all make a point of that, because I don't see any logical relevance to the question before us, which is whether or not a prima facie case was made out for punitives. Of course you stipulated negligence. You had to, obviously.
Right, exactly.
What does it have to do with the punitive point?
I don't think it has anything to do with the punitive damages, Your Honor. I think that the punitive damage theory in the law, and what I was intending to start with is exactly this point, is it's a very high burden. It's a very high standard. And I think that that's where we need to start. That's why I'm putting the negligence aside, because we're in a different...
Well, if you go through the bullet list that was just described to us, could a rational fact finder, not you, me, or someone else disagreeing, but could a rational fact finder look at that and say, you know what, I'm not sure he knew for sure, because that would be an intentional tort, but he was consciously and wantonly disregarding an obvious risk. And if the conscious and willful and knowing disregard of an obvious risk involves a high risk of harm, that's entering in the line, over the line, of punitive damages.
It could, Your Honor. I think my best response to that would be as follows. This court has yet to have passed on a punitive damages case and issued an opinion on a punitive damages case in a medical malpractice case. And I'd like to start with just the notion of the delivery of medical care always has risk. Anytime a prescription is written, even if it's just not a very offensive medication, it can still have there can be an allergy, there can be a side effect, all the way up to things like narcotics like we have here. So any kind of prescription has a risk. Any kind of procedure, of course, has a risk. Doctors are required to disclose those risks. And any kind of decision by a doctor can have risk. So I think that the biggest point I'd like to impress upon the court today is the difference between risk, which exists in everything a doctor does for a patient and every medication used for a patient, and having a conscious awareness that there is likely to be an injury. That is the standard this court has set forth for punitive damage claims. To have a conscious disregard, in fact, the statute says you have to have such recklessness as evinces a conscious disregard for the safety of others. And consciousness, the conscious disregard language, is codified here in the statute, of course, but it's captured from this court's opinions over many, many decades explaining what that means. And what that means, and it's in every single case that has been reported, the standard is that you must believe that it will likely cause an injury. Not that it could, not that it's a risk. Risk is totally different than likelihood. A possibility is the list of risks that appellant just gave this court.
The problem with that, I think, is when the doctor proffered his point, which is he was horrified when he saw all this, right?
Sure.
That implies pretty strongly in his position, your position, is he didn't really know for sure that she hadn't been seen. He's got other things to do, and he's not following that closely. He expects his staff to keep him advised. He didn't see the note in the record about her not being in. You need to talk to him. But why can't the plaintiff say, you know, honestly, I don't believe him, respectfully. You know, memory is what it is, and we all shape our memories based upon self-interest, and he's remembering it incorrectly, and I'm not calling him dishonest, but I don't believe that. I don't believe the fact finder. So if you take out that, what you're left with, he clearly does have conscious disregard.
I don't think he does, because I don't think anybody could have seen that she was going to accidentally overdose on Percocet and alcohol. That is the cause of death, an accidental overdose on Percocet and alcohol. Dr. Highfield never had a situation, nor a set of facts presented to him, that gave him an awareness she was likely to overdose accidentally on alcohol with Percocet. That is not what this list of risks that have been stated supports. It doesn't support that particular conclusion. It could go towards maybe dependency develops, maybe addiction develops, maybe there is a death for some cause, but an accidental overdose from alcohol and Percocet together is not what that set of facts supports.
She's drinking vodka every day, and she's taking thousands of Percocet pills over the course of a long period of time. There's no risk if she's accidentally going to have one or two more than one day.
I think that the evidence shows that for more than a year, this doctor performed 3 surgeries on this patient for trauma, initially for a trauma, and then had to do revisions. And through that time was giving Percocet and was monitoring her and was counseling her and was doing all of the things the standard of care would have required him to do that he neglected to do thereafter. So there was a baseline understanding and relationship between this doctor and the patient. This is not a patient who came in, some of the cases that they cited from out of state, pretty egregious ones. It's nothing like that. It's nothing like a patient who hurt themselves trying their back off and then went in and got Percocet and then the doctor continuously increased it. There was no increase ever. In fact, after the second surgery, he decreased the Percocet and he kept it at the same low level. He made her come back weekly, every week, even after there was the period of time where he stopped seeing the patient, came back every week, make her come back every week to pick up the prescription so that there would be an opportunity to make sure there was some visualization of the patient, to make sure that she was not perhaps out, drunk at the time, things like this. The part of the brief that we put forth and part of the evidence that the judge had in front of it was all of the safeguards that were put in place were still maintained through this period of time where the doctor did not actually see the patient. And I think that the more telling point
What do you mean all of the safeguards? Principal safeguard is the doctor talks to the patient.
Right.
What safeguards are you talking about?
That would be the principal one,
but that wasn't done. That's the whole point.
Right. Right. And I believe that that would be negligent, but I don't believe that that's a conscious disregarding of someone's rights, particularly when there were no red flags that came up at any time during this 14-month period of time where the same amount of medication was given at the same pace, under the same standards that had been given during the time not in question while he was maintaining a more ongoing direct involvement with the patient. I think that the...
Counsel, how would he know that there were no red flags if he didn't see them?
Well, there, in fact, were no red flags that came up. For example, he explained how he has patients who take Percocet. As an orthopedic surgeon, I think one of the things he identified was that's a normal standard medication used for them for trauma cases. And so he's using a lot of Percocet for these trauma patients. And he explained how, in his experience, he will get phone calls from family. He'll get phone calls from the pharmacy for different drug-seeking behaviors, for different types of responses or effects that the medications are giving. These things never happened. As a matter of fact, in this case, he was never told, and it's not that he failed to find out. It just wasn't happening. There were no phone calls to the office of a family saying that she's taking too many or that she's... Rather, she also did not do things like call in and say, hey, I lost my prescription, I need another one, you know, demonstrating that she's accelerating.
Did she get 3 days apart?
Pardon me?
Did she get 2 scripts 3 days apart for 40 pills total towards the end of her life?
That is correct. In May of 20, I think it was 13, what is the last year in May, she did receive, Dr. Highfield did write 2 prescriptions 3 days apart. And I want to note that there were approximately 60 weeks in question and only 52 prescriptions. Obviously, on average, this is less than weekly. And if the court were to take the time to look in the record at the various prescriptions themselves, there'll be notes on there from time to time where she's calling in a little early, saying, the weekend's coming, let me ask you now to have the prescription ready for Friday. So these dates are early and late. So they're not quite 7 days every single time. One example is the one that you just referenced, Your Honor.
Counsel, can I interrupt you just a second and ask your question? All the argument you've been making for the last 10 minutes in response to the appellant's argument seems like this is a classic jury question. Why isn't it a jury question about whether this should be punitive damages or not?
Because I think the question in this case is whether or not there is evidence that Dr. Highfield had a conscious disregard for her safety, and as this court has expressed in the past, the consciousness has to be he believes she is likely to be injured by his activity. He has to consciously, knowingly do something thinking it will likely cause injury. There is no evidence of that. There is no evidence of that. He knows of the risks associated with giving these prescriptions. And those risks for her were no more heightened with his not seeing her in that period of time. The fact that she's bipolar didn't change in that period of time. And the fact that she had drank alcohol daily didn't change much in that time. But the point is that he did not consciously know in that period of time that there was a red flag to warn him that there is a problem to avoid dependency, addiction, or something worse. And punitive damages are not to be attributed for damages that never happened. A lot of the argument we got from plaintiffs was, by giving these prescriptions without monitoring, you can create dependency and addiction and such. There's no allegation of dependency and addiction and such. Those are, again, that's why I'm trying to separate risk from the likelihood of what the injury will be. There are risks of dependency and addiction and such. However, it's not likely it's going to happen when you have a low dose of Percocet maintained at a normal pace without any type of red flag demonstrating a change in the patient's condition. And there is no evidence of any type of change in this patient's condition in that period of time. The plaintiff brought forth no evidence to show that she had been abusing the medication, that she had been drinking excessive alcohol with the medication causing her trouble or any kind of challenges or damages. None of that actually was reported to my client, to my client's practice, nor was it ever even submitted into evidence in this court. So if there is nothing that would
make...
Can
I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I thought I read in the appellant's arguments that addiction did play a role in their theory of the case, and that the ultimate death was a product of overuse that was the platform from which was an addictive behavioral response to the Percocet. But is that not true?
I might not know exactly whether or not that's true. I don't recall that from the record. I don't recall that addiction was ever testified to, that Ms. Curtis became addicted to Percocet. I'm not familiar with that from the record. I'm not saying it's not there, because I'm just not sure. But I'm not
going to go ahead and finish it.
Well, I just think it's a when the court is going to take a case like this and consider when everything that's done in medicine can be risky, and I think the court needs to really grapple with the distinction between understanding what a prospective risk is versus a likelihood of a damage, of a particular damage. And in this particular case, the likelihood of this type of an injury, an accidental overdose of Percocet with alcohol, that particular outcome has to be, in my opinion, what this court has written in the past, has to have been in my client's consciousness that it was likely to happen with what his behavior was doing. And if he didn't consciously believe that, then it's not willful, wanton, or reckless disregard.
Sorry, you only have a minute left, but yeah. I'm reading the complaint, and paragraph 24 says Ms. Curtis became addicted to narcotic pain medication, suffered an accidental overdose, and died.
Right. That might be in the complaint, Your Honor. Again, from the evidence presented at trial, I did not see that referenced to. The addiction aspect of it, a testimony by an expert saying there's addiction. I believe that the court properly struck this because it does not rise to the level that this court has traditionally required cases of punitive damages to rise to, and I think that the court should affirm. Thank you.
Short on time, so I'm going to try to be brief. I think this court, through its questions, understands the issues.
Can you argue addictive behavior or addictive responses to the Percocet played a role in the accidental overdose in support of your motion, your request for punitives?
Absolutely. We pleaded it. It was in the complaint. His failures, his recklessness, led her to become addicted, led her to abuse these medications, led her to overdose on these medications, and led to her death. A jury found that.
Yes.
That is a continuum. That's what happens with these medications, particularly when you start combining them with alcohol, taking more than you should, and are not monitored.
Okay. Thank you. Was that circumstantial or direct? In other words, you had evidence of 144 prescriptions, 7,000 pills, et cetera, all the things you've been talking about, which could lead a fact finder to conclude, in fact, she was addicted and abusing the medication.
Well, it's both. So there's direct evidence that she's abusing the medication. There's no doubt. There's direct evidence that she overdosed from a lethal amount of Percocet, and there's direct evidence that she died. To the addiction question, I think, you know, a juror is going to reasonably find she was addicted to the medication. Unfortunately, our addiction expert was not allowed to testify at this case. That was an issue for appeal. That issue was not granted. You know, it seems to me that the major argument on the defendant's, you know, the appellee's side is, well, he didn't have a conscious awareness. Well, we put on plenty of evidence that he had a conscious awareness. They can put on their evidence that he didn't know. They can put on their evidence that this was nothing but an inadvertent mistake. But it's a jury's job to determine whether or not writing 52 prescriptions in a row, whether those 52 individual mistakes were inadvertent or not. I want to just finish, you know, my argument with a thought about the purpose of punitive damages, particularly in a case like this, because medical malpractice cases should not be any different than other civil cases. This court has recognized, as has the General Assembly, that the purpose of punitive damages in a civil case is to provide for the protection of the public, to punish the defendant for his bad acts, and to warn and deter others from committing similar bad acts. In 2014, the very year that Mary Jo Curtis died, there were 950 overdose deaths here in Virginia. Last year, Virginia set a record. 1,550 people died of drug overdoses in Virginia, a 50% increase. There is no denying that this is a public health crisis.
And if punitive damages are explicitly available in medical malpractice cases and in wrongful death cases, and if their purpose is to protect the public and deter reckless and dangerous behavior that harms the public, it seems glaringly obvious that the reckless pattern of behavior that Dr. Heifeld engaged in and it ultimately caused Mary Jo Curtis's death is the exact type of willful, wanton, reckless behavior that punitive damages was envisioned to punish and to deter. For that, I ask this court to reverse the trial court's decision on punitive damages, allow the jury to do its job and judge the credibility of the witnesses and the evidence, and send this case back down for a new trial on the sole issue of punitive damages. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Please call the next case.